The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversations. This week we're going to be looking at love after loss, and I'm chuffed a bit to be talking to Steve Bland, who is the producer of this podcast. And we had a funny interaction where I texted him saying, would you be a guest? And I think, Steve, you've been waiting for me to figure out that I should have you as a guest, haven't you?
I wouldn't stay waiting for you to figure it out, but I've always thought, you know, I'd like to have this conversation with you.
Well, you could have just made my life a lot easier and stopped my brain having to try and think of a new guest and just said, how about me? Anyway, nice that it happened naturally. I found a great article on The Sun saying, who is Steve Bland, which really, really amused me. But I haven't just gone with their version. This is a bit about Steve. Steve is a producer, a podcaster, a journalist from Cheshire. He was married to Rachel Brand, who was also a BBC presenter and newsreader. Rachel was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2016, 14 months after their son Freddie was born. After her diagnosis, Rachel wanted to tell her story, so persuaded BBC Five Live to commission a podcast. She cast Laura Mann, who I've just had to look at how to say her surname, and I've always had it differently in my head, so this has been a like massive
Mann. Yeah, Laura Mann.
I know, but it's spelt, yeah, not how I'd expect. And Dame Deborah James, and You, Me and the Big C was born. Rach died in September 2018, a week before Freddie's third birthday, and she was aged just 40. At that point, Steve took over presenting, and you guys have won all the awards. And the three of you have recently been awarded honorary doctorates by the University of London at Institute of Cancer Research, which is pretty mega. And the point of this podcast is that in the last few years, you've met Amy, who you went on to marry this year. So we're going to be talking about love after loss. But I'm going to start with those three questions that we just started chatting about off mic. So how are you really? What star sign are you? And what's your favourite crisp?
Okay, so I'll start with the easy one, the crisps. Mm. And I know we've spoken about this just a few minutes ago. I love a kettle chip. I'm really sorry because I know you've got big issues with kettle chips, but I love a kettle chip. Or for a more fun crisp, I'm big into hula hoops.
I mean, hula hoops are an exceptional crisp, so you've redeemed yourself there. But I just find kettle chips too hard.
Well, but that's why I like them. They're a good dipping crisp. You know, a little bit of hummus or a tzatziki or something. They're a great dipping crisp.
Or a scooping crisp, maybe.
Or a scooping crisp, yeah.
Okay, any particular flavour of kettle chips or all of them?
No, all of them, really, all of them. And star sign-wise, I don't actually know what this means, but I'm a Cancer. I think I've said this to you before. I'm just not into star signs. I just don't get it. I just don't, yeah.
Not into.
It's just not my thing.
Yeah, do you want to know a bit about what a Cancer is like?
I do. I would actually quite like to, yeah.
But they're very homely. They're real homebodies. That's mainly the most, they're kind of like a very nurturing sign in the zodiac, can possibly be a little bit indecisive and struggle to move forward with things. But the homeliness is the biggest trait.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm indecisive.
What was Rachel and what is Amy?
So Amy's March 22nd. I don't know what that makes her.
An Aries, so quite feisty, quite full in the china shop sometimes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Rachel was January the 21st.
So probably a Capricorn, quite old school values, quite stoic and can dig in.
Yeah, yeah, again, makes sense. But the thing is, though, you could probably pick like typical characteristics from any star sign and you'd find them in yourself, I think.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, as you know from hearing me bang on, there's more complexity to it, and I could talk for a whole episode. I won't waste it.
But you have done.
Yeah, I have, and it was very successful, as you know. Cancer, are you emotional, Steve? You are emotional. I know that to be true. So,
yeah,
I think you're quite Cancerian, to be honest.
And how am I really? I'm okay at the moment. I'm tired. We're very tired in our house just at the minute because we're just getting used to a new way of life with you know, we got married a couple of months ago, and I've been living on my own with, well, Freddie and the dog for a little while, and Amy had been with her, you know, her two cats in a little terrace house, and we're just getting used to, you know, life as a bigger family again, and it's taken a little bit of time. The sleeping isn't the best, just because the dog isn't really settling and he's pacing around, and there's wooden floor, so you can hear his little claws clip clopping around, and the cats are messing around in the middle of the night, and yeah, Freddie took a bit of time to settle, and Amy's not the best sleeper anyway, so yeah. Yeah, the sleeping situation is not the best, but that aside, I'm very happy at the moment with personal life. It's all great.
I mean, I know from doing this together, you have had a hell of a summer. There was a point when you were just, I was just like, wow, you're having major life events. And we're not in the summer now, but major life events left, right and centre. And actually, probably sometimes once life does settle and you get to the other side of all of those massive mountains, then I think there's a bit of processing goes on, isn't there? And trying to settle into something that you've actually really longed for over the course of the last however long. And then you're like, oh, right, we're here.
That's definitely true. And you know, I think the summer sort of, you know, got off to a difficult start with Deb, you know, losing Deb, and then yeah, it kind of moved on to happier things like house moves and weddings and that, you know, not weddings, there's only been one wedding and only two house moves, but yeah. You know, moved on to happier things, but it was quite emotionally, you know, draining in the space of a couple of weeks. We were buying houses, selling houses, you know, trying to sort out a wedding, and all the while, you know, only a few weeks after, you know, after saying goodbye to our very good friend. So it was a big emotional summer, but yeah, like you say, we're out the other side now and getting used to, you know, the new reality of life.
Yeah, it's a lot, you're kind of doing all the extremes in quite a condensed thing, and you had your stag and hen do's, didn't you, and then you were getting your doctorate. It was wild. So yeah, I'm not surprised you're tired.
Yeah, like I say, a lot of it, I think I'm quite a people pleaser. I don't know if that's a Cancerian thing, but I'm quite a people pleaser. So I'm like my dad was exactly the same. So I'm happiest when everybody around me is happy and everyone around me is, you know, rested and content and everything. And you know, so Amy not sleeping kind of has a knock-on effect that I worry about that, and then yeah, but yeah, we're all good. We're just getting used to the new reality of life, but it's all exciting and all good.
So let's get into this. I feel weird having this chat. It's always strange. Steve and I actually haven't met, but we spent many hours on the mic together. So it's quite a weird thing to then suddenly go straight into a big chat. But let's do it. Describe to me meeting Rach, falling in love with Rach. How was that experience?
Yeah, it was. So let's go back a little bit. I was a producer at BBC Radio 5 Live, and Rachel was a was a news reader at Five Live. She did a bit of bits and bobs on the news channel as well. And it was actually when Five Live moved up to Manchester in 2012, end of 11, start of 12. And we had some mutual friends. We met a couple of times. We never really talked that much, but we ended up, I moved in with a couple of mates in a little village called Hale, just outside Manchester. And Rachel, not really knowing where she was, you know, where she should be, you know, moving up from London, she moved into Hale as well. And just by chance, really. And I was living with a couple of mates who knew Rachel quite well. So she came over one evening and we just got chatting. And then over the sort of next few weeks, we got chatting more and more and more. And then Christmas came, Christmas 2011, and we didn't really see each other over Christmas, but it was very obvious, you know, from the messages, you know, that we were, we're getting on great. And then she came back in January, and we just hit it off like straight away. It turns out she, there was a friend of ours who we used to call Jaeger Ben because he loved Jägermeister. Well, still does love Jägermeister. And it turns out she bet Ben like 4 bottles of Jägermeister that we'd been married by the end of the year, because she was so sure about it. It didn't quite happen that year, but it happened the following year. And what did it happen that year? I'm trying to think when we actually got married. No, the following year, September 2013. So yeah, it was a bit of a whirlwind, but I think it is a little bit easier in a way when you're in your late 30s, early 40s. I think you've got a bit more clarity about things, and you know, you sort of don't really, or this is me anyway, I don't really pursue stuff that you don't think has got, you know, you might not know straight away that you're going to be with that person, but I think as you get a bit older, you probably know if you're not. And I think so it was all fairly quick. We got engaged the following February, March time. And then after September, we had a good run of a couple of years. And then obviously, well, Freddie arrived, which was, you know, marvelous. And then unfortunately, the cancer came in November 2016.
And what kind of diagnosis was she given at that point?
So she found, I remember walking into our bedroom and she was lying on her back, just like prodding just underneath I can't think if it was right or left, but underneath her breast it was. And she just said, "Can you just feel this for me?" And it just felt like, I mean, people say this all the time, but it just felt like a small walnutty, like sort of a bumpy, you know, very small, very, you know, oddly shaped, but very hard and very definitely there, lump. And so she went to the doctor, and you know, they tell you this all the time, a lot of lumps and bumps, particularly after breastfeeding, because, you know, Freddie was only 14 months old, so she hadn't long stopped breastfeeding. You know, there's a lot of changes in the breasts, aren't there? There's a lot going on. So, you know, a lot of lumps and bumps are often explained by that and turn out to be nothing, which is obviously what we hope for. But it was, you know, a couple of scans later and it was very obvious that it was breast cancer. And it was triple negative breast cancer, which I don't know if, you know, anybody will know too much about, but there's different kinds of breast cancer. Triple negative is the slightly more, well, less treatable one, the slightly more aggressive one. Outcomes are not as good, because there are fewer treatments that work for it. And like initially they don't sort of know straight away. They have to do obviously all the scans. They did the scans and they found it was in a couple of lymph nodes under the arm, which is like the sort of safety net for the breast. It's a long story, but it never really started going right. You know, you hear people all the time, they have time, you know, periods of remission or periods when they, you know, they get the all clear or you know, they think it's all kind of going well, but it never really went like that for us. It was just kind of, you know, difficult news after difficult news. And And then, you know, sort of early-ish in 2018, like mid-2018, it was just going wrong, and it had spread across. She'd had a mastectomy on the side, and all the skin started going all mottly and all like rashy. And this is inflammatory breast cancer. It was in the skin. And, you know, once it's in the skin, once it's in a different part of the body into the primary site, then it means it's, you know, metastatic, and it means it's moving around in the blood, and it's not curable at that point. So, yeah. And then, yeah, skip forward a couple of months. She died in September 2018, about a week or so before Freddie's third birthday.
It's and she was 40. How old were you when that happened?
A couple of years younger, so I was 38.
So you're 38, and you find yourself as a widower. It's a mad piece of language. You're just trying to get used to being married, then being a father, and then you're in this role that you just never expect at that age.
It's it was. You know, people say it all the time, don't they? It's one of those things that happens to other people, cancer, and even with breast cancer, you think, you know, we all know stories. We all know people, our parents, friends, or whatever, who've had it and been treated, and the treatments are like remarkable now, and the stats are amazing for breast cancer that's caught early. The stats are incredible, the treatments are incredible, the outcomes are getting better and better and better. It was, and it still is, you know, hard to take that, you know, we were on the other end of the, you know, the good stats. Mm. You know, we were the small percentage that, you know, don't make it out the other side. And it was difficult to take, but at the same time, it was a situation that we were in, and I'm quite a practical person. And so, you know, while it was very difficult, I was very aware that there was, you know, little point in wallowing and being sorry for myself. And yeah, because I had a 14-month-old, well, not 14-month-old, a nearly 3-year-old boy who needed looking after, and I wasn't gonna let his, you know, his health or his childhood be affected any more than it had to be. And so, yeah, and so we just kind of cracked on and did the best that we could.
And did you, in that time, manage to talk about, like, your future? I'm sure you did, but about what Rachel's wishes were for you going forward and for Fred?
Yeah, we talked about it quite a lot. I mean, one of the amazing things with Rachel was how open she became, particularly, you know, towards the end when she knew, you know, when she knew that it probably wouldn't have a good outcome, she was just like remarkably open and generous in terms of, you know, not thinking about herself. It was, you know, she just wanted to make sure that everyone else was around her. Rachel was a worrier about, she worried about what people thought, probably too much. And the thought that she was, you know, leaving this kind of destruction behind her, leaving this awful situation behind her was really difficult for her. And it was actually, in a way, it was harder than actually what was happening to her. She, you know, she really struggled with the impact it was going to have on everyone around her. And so we had a lot of conversations, like, just to reassure her that I was going to be all right, Freddie was going to be all right. And as part of that, you know, I remember one of her big worries was that she said, like, we've been married for, you know, for not very long, you know, 4 or 5 years at the time. You know, you'll marry someone else and you'll be with them for 40 years and I'll just be a little footnote. You know, that was a big thing for her. But despite that, and obviously I told her that's, you know, never going to be the case, but despite that, she was still, you know, very clear that I should be happy in whatever form that took, you know, whether that meant, you know, being by myself, whether that meant meeting someone, you know, whatever it might be, I should be happy because I was, yeah, like I say, I was only 38. I had an awful lot of living to do. And, you know, a little boy, like I say, she did say very clearly, I'd love Freddie to have a mother figure in his life. And like, you can't imagine now, well, I mean, you probably can imagine that you've got kids and you're not a dissimilar age. Like you can't, it's hard to imagine having those conversations and thinking that, you know, that clearly about, you know, your little boy growing up without you. It must have just been so difficult for her.
Yeah. But
it was those conversations and how open she was though, that gave me real clarity in what I, and not what I was allowed to do, but like how I should approach, you know, my life afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate kind of act of selflessness, isn't it? Like the thing that you most wish you could be, which is continue to be your wife and continue to be Freddie's mother, you're kind of consciously handing it over to someone else or consenting for it to be handed over to someone else. It's incomprehensible, isn't it? But it's really interesting to hear that bit of character that she was so worried about the aftermath, because there's a great Alain de Botton quote which is like, don't worry about the people that have died because they're okay, and it is true. Like it is true. It is how it shows up for the people afterwards, but I can't even imagine.
It's so true. That is so true. Like, we talked about it a lot, and I've heard other people talk about it. It's it's obviously really difficult for the person going through cancer, but in a lot of different ways it's almost harder for the people watching from the outside, or, you know, the outside, inside, whatever you want to call it, but watching on from the sidelines to a degree, because even though, you know, I was obviously right in the middle of it, but you're still unable to do anything. You can't help the situation. You can't make it better. You can't, you know, there's nothing that you can do. And then you do have to deal with this. I remember a friend of mine said it's like a car crash, and you just have to try and pull something out of it that you pull something out of the debris and you try and make something positive out of it. And I'm genuinely a better person because of it, and I think I'm a lot more able to appreciate life, and I've got a much better outlook on things, and that's not to say that it was a good thing, because obviously it wasn't. It was horrendous. But I find it quite hard to get in my head like how good things are now as a result of this awful thing.
Yeah, I was thinking actually, and I've written down, I remember you saying to me about taking Amy to Salcombe, and that Salcombe was somewhere that you and Rachel loved together, and just how much of an amazing but unbelievable head spin that is, but because it's by the loss of one of the loves of your life that you have ended up having the opportunity to fall in love with another, and that's such a hard thing to hold in your head, isn't it?
I was chatting to my sister actually about this kind of similar stuff. My sister has got three kids now, but after she'd had her first daughter, Imogen, she had a little baby called Charlie who died after 5 or 6 days. He had a placenta abruption during labour, and he didn't make it. And it's really difficult, because I've had two kids since, and it's really difficult to square this, you know, the joy from the kids that you've got, but you've only got them because of what happened to, you know, to Charlie, who they lost. It's really difficult. Salcombe was a funny one, and I don't know if we'll go back there again. It's just it was such a part of Rachel and I, and I don't know if we'll go there again. I think I'd like to find a place that's a place for Amy and I, you know, a place that we love and that we want to go back to. And, you know, there are too many ghosts, I think, in Salcombe. It's just, we've been there so many times. There are too many places that I look at and I go, that's where we did that, or that's where we did that. And it's a really small place, you know, so you can't get away from it. It's as much as I love it, I don't know if we'll go back.
And also, I think sometimes you don't want to erase some of those memories either, do you? Like, it's quite nice to keep something preserved. I don't know.
This is the thing. Like, I get accused of kind of leaving Rachel out of things quite a lot. If I post, I remember when I posted some pictures of Freddie's birthday last year, and we were all out of Pizza Express, and they were all pictures of Freddie with Amy and stuff, and I had like 4 or 5 messages from people saying, like, how can you not post a picture of Rachel with Freddie? And like, you know, I think it's really disrespectful and all that kind of thing. I get it quite a lot. And it's really hard. Like you know, this idea that if you don't post it on social media, then it's not happening. If you're not sharing a memory on social media, then you haven't got that memory. You know, if you have to share everything, otherwise it's not there. Like, you know, I have got so many wonderful memories that we tell Freddie about all the time. And Rachel's a massive part of our life, a huge part of Freddie's life. And that will never change whether I post a picture of her on Freddie's birthday or not. The reality is that I've got to be looking forward now, and you know, that's exactly the way that she would want it. It's just, I mean, you know what it's like. Some people on social media, they love to have an opinion, and they think that once you start sharing a lot, they're entitled to more of an opinion.
I mean, it's so unbelievably hurtful, isn't it? I mean, how could Freddie's mother not be front of your mind on his birthday? Of course she is. I mean, it's how, what do they want? Yeah, I mean,
but I've also got this. I also have this balance, because, you know, my future is Amy now, and it's difficult for her, because Rachel was, you know, clearly incredible and clearly held in such high esteem by so many people. And it's very difficult for Amy when, you know, when that kind of stuff is constantly brought up and constantly, you know, made reference to. It's very difficult for her to, you know, she has said to me lots of times that she feels like she's living in Rachel's shadow a lot of the time. And you know, we've taken down a lot of, well, I mean, moving into the new house, we didn't really put up, you know, pictures of Rachel so much anymore, because, you know, because that's not our life anymore. And it's really difficult. It's a really difficult balance. But I think, I just feel like I have to have eyes forward now. You know, you have to be thinking of the future. And like I said, I'm certain that's the way that Rachel would want.
Yeah, that's the important piece of the puzzle. It's not as if you didn't have these conversations and she didn't. If her overriding fear was that that she didn't want you to be held back, then you're honouring that. And as you say, you've got to do what feels right. No, none of us know what it is like to sit in your shoes until we've done it, and so you know what is right based on your instincts.
Yeah. And I think I was very clear after she died that I mean, I knew that I would be all right. I knew that I would be. And you know, we talked about that a lot. And I knew that I would be because, you know, because I think, yeah, I think I am, just because of my character, I think, and my personality, I think I knew, not that I would get over it, you know, not that it'd be fine, but I knew that I would find a way to kind of push on. And I remember talking to Simon Thomas, who's his wife Gemma died about a year before Rachel, Sky News presenter, and he said, you know, he said he was determined not just to have a good life, but, you know, that it shouldn't be a second class version of life. It shouldn't be. You know, he wanted to be as happy, if not happier again, you know, than he had been with Gemma. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it, because you're not just trying to hit that level again. You know, once you've had that, you want to go even further. You want to be, even happier. And I think because of the way that something like this impacts you and the way you look at life, I think that's kind of where I am, because, you know, all those awful cliches about how these things are supposed to affect you, you know, they're all true. You do appreciate life more. You do realize how much of a blessing it is. You do understand how getting old is a blessing. You know, every birthday, you know, you don't whinge about turning 40 or turning whatever, you know, because every single birthday is a blessing. And I think, you know, it's quite sad that you don't get that perspective without having something, you know, disastrous in your life. Mm. I was chatting to a guy last week, and I hosted this conference, this Manchester Cancer Conference. And I was chatting to a guy who was speaking at the end of it. And a guy called Martin Hibbert, who was paralyzed in the Manchester bomb at the arena five years ago. And he paralyzed from the belly button down. Obviously life turned upside down. His daughter, his 14-year-old daughter at the time, was, you know, very severely injured. And he was talking a lot about the way that he is now compared to the way that he was then. And you know, would he want that to have happened? Of course he wouldn't. You go back in a heartbeat if you could and stop that happening. But he was talking about how his life now, you know, he understands the value of it, and he can appreciate life, and he's almost a better person because of what happened. And I think that's, you know, that's the that's the funny thing, that you don't want these things to have happened, but in a way it does give you that perspective on life where you just can't get any other way. And it's quite sad that we don't get it until something like this happens, you know, just how precious life is and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the way. It's from the dark. As you say, those cliches are cliches for a reason. From the darkest things come all the good stuff. But it's, yeah, if only you'd known in the depths of that time after Roach died. But I don't know. Yeah, you can only know when you know.
It's a funny perspective that you get, both when, you know, when you've lost, but also, you know, the perspective that, you know, Deborah had. You know, when you know your time is limited as well, you don't get that kind of insight any other way other than knowing that your time's limited. And yeah, it's quite sad. It is quite sad that it takes that kind of thing for us to, you know, to actually appreciate how lucky we are in so many ways.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Do you think that perspective shaped, well, I'm interested in, because actually you mentioned the cancer conference. Isn't that where you met Amy a few years ago? And how did that meeting, how did that meeting happen? And does this perspective help you grab onto something when you know it's good?
Yeah, for sure it does. This cancer conference is an annual thing, but it wasn't held for a couple of years during COVID. So the last one was 2019, and it's the Greater Manchester Cancer Conference. So it's all all the people that work in cancer right across Greater Manchester, all the different hospitals all come together to share insight, share innovation, share kind of all the research things they're working on, all the big all the big pilots, the big, you know, big projects they're working on. It's inspiring, actually, you know, to see what's going on. And in 2019, Deb and Lauren and I were invited to speak on to sort of close the conference on the second day. So we did about an hour on the second afternoon, and it was the last thing we actually ever did as a threesome, you know, live at an event. Because obviously then, you know, COVID hit, you know, the next year. But I remember Lauren talking about having a fuck it list rather than a bucket list at the conference. And afterwards we were walking out, and Amy, who Amy just came up to me and just introduced herself and made reference to that, you know, what Lauren had said about, you know, sort of grabbing a moment, or, you know, sort of seizing the moment a little bit, and she introduced herself, but she said that we'd actually already met, because she worked on a ward at the Christie Hospital where if you spike a fever or a temperature, or you have some symptoms that need looking at, you come into the hospital, and the first ward you get, you go into, was the one where Amy works. So you're admitted into that ward, and then if they need to send you off for a further whatever, you're sent off to different parts of the hospital. So she treated Rachel in the June or July before she died in September, and I do remember her. She said I was actually quite rude, because I was trying to work in the hospital room, and I just didn't really speak to her, apparently. But anyway, so she introduced herself, and we just got chatting, and then I can't remember if it was me or her. Shared messages on Instagram or Twitter or something, and then met up a couple of weeks later, and it just all kind of all went from there. But yeah, it was that conference. I said to them at the conference, there were like 700 people in the room, and I said I love the people of Greater Manchester who work in cancer so much that I even married one of you. It was a very special conference for me, you know, for a couple of different reasons, but. Yeah, that's where it all started.
And in that experience of falling in love with her, were you aware, was part of you holding yourself back because of, you know, I'm sure, as you said, the things that are laddered at you, which is too soon, not giving enough time to grieve Rachel, or were you just, as you said, I've met someone special, I'm going to go for this?
Yeah, that's kind of how I was. I think she... you know, I didn't hold herself back, but she, you know, she was a little more cautious than I was, particularly around things like meeting Freddie. She didn't want to meet Freddie for a while until we knew that it was, you know, something serious. And she was right, but then it became very difficult, you know, to not include Freddie. He's so much a big part of my life that you can't, you know, I couldn't have these two separate bits and build an actual relationship with Amy while, you know, not introducing it to Freddie. So, I was all in, you know, from quite an early point, and it's gone pretty well.
And what about then the wedding? You know, I kept thinking, you know, you've stood and made those vows twice, and I think maybe when we're younger and we make them, I think, well, I'm talking about myself, you're so naive that you can't possibly imagine the death to us part of it, because at that point in your life you feel so invincible, and then there you are doing it, and you know the reality of that, those vows.
It's just something that you say, isn't it? You just repeat after the vicar or the celebrant, whatever it is, you know, whoever it is doing your wedding. It's just something that you say, and I think it definitely, the whole day this time, and I don't like comparing. I've never liked comparing anything. I don't want to. People have asked me about the differences between Amy and Rachel, and I don't like comparing. I don't. The one of the news one of the newspapers keeps doing it, and you know, said that I'd married a lookalike of Rachel and stuff, and they don't look anything like each other, and I never want to compare, but I think it's fair to compare, like, the way that I looked at the two different days. I definitely understood it a lot better second time. I understood what I was doing. I understood how important it was. Understood how important what I was saying was. And I definitely think, you know, everyone talks about like your wedding day just goes by in a blur and you don't really get a chance to appreciate it. When you do it for a second time, you know, you get to take a moment and actually understand it and appreciate it. And you know, I'm not advocating that everyone should do it more than once. You know, don't pack your marriages up just to do it again. But it was a blessing to be able to do it again and to actually understand, you know, how special it was and you know, really take it all in and appreciate it and enjoy it. And I definitely think I enjoyed it a lot more than the first one.
Yeah, because you just can appreciate it, can't you? I think the older you get, I mean, I don't go to many weddings anymore because you get to that age where they just kind of dry up, don't they? But, you know, once upon a time, it was all about the party, which it still is. But I'm always so moved by the actual ceremony bit. Once you have been married and you know what that means to commit your life to someone, it really is an unbelievably big thing. But so often I think people don't realize that when they're standing there doing that.
No, they don't. You're definitely right. And I was very aware. It was quite an emotional day. My good friend Dave did the actual ceremony. He does a lot of like local preaching and stuff in churches. He's a really good friend of mine, and because the timings didn't work out for the celebrant to be there at the time that we wanted, so she came a little bit later in the afternoon to do the legal bit. And the actual ceremony was just, you know, was just Dave doing it, you know, just our mate doing it, and you know, we did all the same stuff, made the same promises, did all, you know, all the same stuff, but it was just really, really, really special just having him there. No, you know, there was no one there we didn't know. Everyone there was important. And it was really, really, really special.
In fact, I went to a friend's humanist wedding, and during the ceremony, I don't know what you call a humanist person, but they're like, you know, when you get married, every single person in this room, if they are the right people, are making a commitment to this couple too. And I think, again, the older you get, when my marriage has been through patchy bits, it is because of the people that are around you that definitely do hold that together. And I think, again, you can sometimes underestimate that as you shuffle into a wedding ceremony. It done right, it is a community effort.
100%. I mean, I've been to so many weddings, and you'll have the same in your late 20s, early 30s. You go to a wedding every week, don't you? Like, you know, six or seven, and you know, every summer there was five, six, seven weddings, and you just sort of go for the party, don't you? You just sort of go because it's a great thing. Ours to me anyway, like, just felt different. I understood a lot more about what I was doing, and a lot more about the commitment, the promises I was making, and you know, how important they were, and how much a blessing it was to have all our family there, and you know, all our friends there. It was just magic, and it was just Rachel's mum was there, which was nice as well. You know, just, you know, it was important for her to be there, I think, and she's been great with everything, because she, you know, she understood. I'm sure it's difficult for her as well, but she understood. You know, she understood Rachel's point of view on things and what Rachel wanted, and you know, again, it comes back to, I've said it a million times, you know, having those conversations before it's too late. You know, having the conversations about death. We're terrible at talking about death in this country, absolutely terrible. And if we were a bit more open about it, then I think, you know, situations like mine, people would understand a lot more. You know, my perspective. it's when we the people who like you talked about the vow before, until death there was part. Well, you know, the reality was death did us part, and you know, so then you know I wanted to be happy. I had, you know, 40, I don't know however many years left. I'm going to enjoy them, and I'm going to be happy, because I'm not just going to curl up in a ball and be sorry for myself. So but I do think it all comes down to talking about death and how open we are talking about these things, and having conversations early about, you know, we did a session last week at this conference about palliative care and hospices and things. And they were talking about the perceptions of hospices and you know, the kind of misconceptions around palliative care, and you know, it all comes back to how awful we are and how unwilling we are to talk about death. You know, there's a really, really amazing palliative care consultant, former palliative care consultant, called Catherine Mannix, who's written a great book called With the End in Mind, and it's all about the way we look at death, and she compares, you know, the day that we're brought into the world and the day that we leave the world. And so much effort, you know, 9 months of planning goes into giving birth, and then the other end of our life, the other day that's not 24 hours long, you know, we just don't want to talk about, you know, we don't want to engage with, we don't want to even think about until that moment comes. And it just makes it a million times more difficult, and not just for the person who's dying, but for everybody around them as well.
Yeah, exactly. And as we've talked about a few times in this podcast, it is the one certain thing, yet we hide away from it. But it's, yeah, I think that's the gift of doing this kind of work. And for you, for all constantly talking about cancer, it's like you forget that it is awkward for some people now, and it's kind of like a muscle that you just have to flex, isn't it? That you have to talk about over and over again. And it doesn't mean that it shields you from it being horrendous when it happens within your family, but you do become better at it.
I wasn't very good at it, I don't think. And then obviously Rachel started the podcast, and then in the sort of 6 months before she died, she wrote a book as well. And I had to I had to read her chapters as she was writing them. You know, which became very difficult towards the end. It was heartbreaking stuff, but it, you know, forced me to open up and to, you know, actually be able to talk about these things. And you know, a lot of that was down to Rachel. I remember her, I remember she was trying to arrange something for after she died, and her mum was having a bit of trouble kind of talking about it, you know, saying, you're not going to die. And Rachel got quite cross with her and said, Mum, you have to get on board with this. You know, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. And you know, I need this sorting out before, you know, to give me peace of mind. And I think it's, you know, those kind of conversations and how open Rachel was, that really forced me to be open, which has then, you know, then led on to me being able to do the podcast. And, you know, with Lauren and Deb, we just talked about some of these topics like they were, you know, like we're having a chat over a cup of tea. You know, it just became so normal. And I think that's what the point of the podcast was, you know, for people with cancer who want to talk about it. And then all of us people who don't understand it don't want to talk about it. And it makes this awkward, you know, makes it into a bit of a taboo when it really shouldn't be. And the people it really affects are the people with cancer who have nowhere to turn. They feel like they've got a dirty secret they can't tell anybody about. And the podcast was all about getting rid of that. And I mean, Deb, you know, both of them, Lauren and Deb, but I mean, Deborah, you know, genuinely put cancer on the front page of every single newspaper, and you know, with her fabulousness and her dancing and her glamour and her, you know, her sparkles and her dresses and everything. It was, what Rachel, Deb and Lauren and in the podcast have done for people with cancer is extraordinary, I think. And it's made genuinely, you changed the world for people with cancer. I really think it has.
This is, as you're speaking, that's exactly what I was thinking. Because if we now think back to Rachel Dye in 2018 and then the landscape of this now, it's remarkable the shifts that we've seen.
Yeah.
And the public speaking about cancer. It's, yeah, it's like night and day, really, isn't it? Or, yeah, it feels that way. And so, of course, as you said, you would never choose this journey, but there's no doubt of the legacy of her life, because it continues to grow. I mean, probably way beyond your lifetime as well. It's amazing.
Oh, so much good has come out of it all. And yeah, that's all you can hope for, isn't it, when something bad happens, that something good comes out of it, and you know, some people are affected positively, and you know, you look at, you know, people, there's a really healthy kind of Instagram community now of people with cancer. There's, you know, some have got hundreds of thousands of followers. Deb had 1 million by the time she died, you know, just a former head teacher with cancer. But you go back to when the podcast began, you know, it started because that community wasn't there, and the way that cancer was being portrayed in the media, you know, wasn't the way they saw themselves. And I think I found like Rachel's like pitch document that she'd written for Five Live a little while ago, and it had a few people that she'd like to be on, and obviously top of the list were Deb and Lauren. And I think Deb had sort of recently started her column with The Sun, and Lauren was just sort of starting to build Girl Versus Cancer as a community. And they had, you know, a few thousand followers each, and you know, nobody really knew anything about them, but it was some pretty inspired casting, really, wasn't it? Because what, you know, what the three of them, and what obviously what Deb and Lauren, you know, went on to do was fairly extraordinary.
Yeah, unbelievably extraordinary. And I mean, the thing is, whenever you say Deb's name, you can't help but grin, because it is so extraordinary to have witnessed. I was wondering, I don't know what your relationship is with Seb, Deborah's husband. Were you in touch with him in the days after Deborah died? And it must be strange to kind of be witnessing someone else going through a version of what you went through.
Yeah, I was in touch with him both before she died and after she died, and he I don't think you'd mind me saying, he's a bit more of a private kind of guy. You know, doesn't really have a big social media presence and stuff. You know, they've left that to Deb's, this fabulous mum, who is just
doing her proud,
just magnificent. I mean, all the family are amazing, to be fair, and they've all dealt with it, you know, as best you can, and you know, they're all determined to carry on, you know, a lot of what she started. Obviously the Baobab Fund that they launched before she died, and all that kind of thing, that's all, you know, all going to go from strength to strength, I've no doubt. But yeah, Seb, we've talked a bit, we've not talked for a couple of months now, and I hope he knows that I'm on the end of the phone if ever he needed. It's a difficult one, because I guess you deal with it all, you know, in your own way, and he might see it differently to the way I see it, and but we do speak. We have spoken a little bit, I need to check in with him, actually, and the kids are, honestly, Deb's kids are extraordinary kids. They both spoke at her funeral, and like, you know, she'd have been so proud of what they did.
Yeah. Yeah, those genetics run through in a strong way.
Oh, massively. Yeah. I mean, her daughter is like a daughter, Eloise, like a little mini me. She's just exactly the same. Like the same sass, attitude, everything. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's quite something. I'm trying to look for ways to wrap up beyond the kind of end question I'm going to ask you. But if someone is listening, either with a partner who's had a terminal diagnosis or having just lost a partner, is there any advice that you would give them?
I think, having said all the stuff that I've just said in the last hour, one thing I did do was that, in my determination to be all right and be seen like I was getting on with my life and all that kind of thing, I think I I probably rushed. You know, the first few months after Rachel died, I probably rushed things a little bit. I don't mean like romantically. I just mean I was just so determined to be all right. And I think, you know, you need to know that there's light at the end of the tunnel. You need to know that you're going to be fine, and you're going to have a good life, and that's, you know, that'll all come. But if I could go back and tell myself again, I would say just take your time a little bit more. Like just make sure that, you know, you're okay before you charge off and get stuck back into life again. I think I probably just, you know, rushed it a little bit. The other one I think is just to go easy on yourself, because I think it's, you know, it's a pretty monumental thing in losing a partner, and if you're not feeling all right, like I said, just take your time, go easy on yourself, but just know that you'll get there in the end. It might take a little bit of time, but you'll get there in the end, and there's no quick fix.
I think that's it. Funny you're saying about rushing out there. I actually watched a clip of you on Lorraine. I think it must have been quite soon after Rachel died. And obviously I've not met you in real life, but I know you well enough to go, wow, you're doing such a good job of being there, and like your brain is working, but the lights were off behind your eyes so very clearly. But you do what you do in grief, don't you? You do whatever it is. And yes, you know, in an ideal case, you give yourself plenty of room and you do all the mourning, but then you're just human and you're just wiggling through things in the way that feels right at that time.
Do you know what that was, actually? That was, I think that clip will have been when I went, the first time that I went on. I've been on Lorraine quite a few times now. She's a big supporter of our podcast. And the first time was when I was doing the promo for Rachel's book. So this is in, you know, the new year after Rachel died in September. And that was all very surreal and very difficult. And I hadn't done anything, you know, on that side of the camera before. I hadn't done the podcast, you know, I hadn't started doing the podcast by that point. I hadn't done anything on telly. I hadn't done anything. And it was all incredibly surreal and incredibly overwhelming. You're going on all these different TV shows and radio shows to talk about your wife who only died a couple of months before. You're trying to push a book. It was all very, 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 very surreal.
Yeah. Oh, bless you. Little did you know, that was actually the beginning of what would be quite a big part of your career now, but it's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
So my last couple of questions, which you know from having edited this many times, but where can people find you?
On Instagram, on Twitter as well, but I do enjoy Instagram for the cancery stuff. The community is lovely, and I think if you have got cancer, if someone that you know or you love has got cancer, Instagram is a really good place. You know, there are so many people with amazing stories, sharing their stories, sharing advice, sharing tips. You know, there's a lovely community there, and I'm on there too at Mr_Blandy, and yeah, Twitter as well. But Twitter's a bit of a funny place, isn't it?
And then my last question is, as you know, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
This is so funny because I've heard you ask this so many times and I'd never, until this morning, I'd never even considered what my answer would be. A very good friend of mine killed himself about 10 years ago, and you know, not a day goes by without me thinking I want to talk to him again and try and understand him, try and understand what he was going through. And it was all a massive shock to us at the time, and it still is 10, 11 years later. So yeah, I'd love to talk to Tom. He was a very special guy, and I miss him an awful lot.
Thank you, Steve, for your time. It's been an amazing conversation. For the audience, when I do my outro, Steve always politely comes off mic so that I can do the outro without him hearing. Now I've got to do an outro about his episode. which feels very awkward to talk about a conversation with someone when they're there. But that conversation was everything I'd hoped it would be. It feels very special to be able to have spoken to Steve about that. And also, as ever, to kind of lean into one of those very universal fears. I think we all fear dying, but we fear losing someone we love perhaps even more. And so to feel comfortable enough to have that conversation and to know that from the darkness comes light is hugely reassuring. So yeah, it's fantastic. And I'm going to do a huge segue now and say thank you so much for listening. That's another episode of But Why Done. You can find us at But Why Podcast on Instagram or email butwhy@clemmytelford. And I'm now going to research mattress toppers. Did you know about mattress toppers? I went to Dunelm, my new favourite shop, last night to buy a duvet. And there's a big section of mattress toppers. I didn't know this was a thing. Then I went on Mumsnet. There's a lot of threads about it. Have I been missing out? I'm going to find out. I'll let you know. So that's it. Thank you. Catch you next time. Bye. I'm done. See you.